Welcome back to another episode of Recruitment Journeys with me, Pete Watson from Mint R2R, Australia's longest serving rec to rec. Unapologetic plug there, completely shameless. Recruitment Journeys is the original and longest running podcast dedicated to you, the Australian recruitment industry. And in this podcast, as ever, we chat to hand-selected recruitment identities about the highs and the lows of their particular recruitment journeys in the hope to educate, inspire, and motivate you, our listeners. Now, please remember, on the off chance that you've listened to one of these episodes and indeed enjoyed it, it would be massively appreciated if you could like, share, or subscribe, or ideally, all three. We don't ask for much at Recruitment Journeys, just a little bit of love. Massive thanks to our sponsors, A Positive Finance. Everything you need to start or scale your recruitment business. Right, that's enough of the intros. It's all taken care of. Let's get into the next episode of Recruitment Journeys. How many of us can truly say that they've made recruitment work for them? Well, this man certainly can. Swapping the illuminations of Blackpool for the palm trees of Miami, James Ward has had a glittering career in the industry that we call recruitment. From top billing contract recruiter at the S3 Group to international rec to rec, Wardy has seen it all. And it was lovely reconnecting with James after all these years and talking through all things S3, rec to rec, and just recruitment life in general. Those of you who know Wardy will know that he's one of the industry's good guys. And so I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Mr. James Ward from Clarity, R2R. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. How are you, mate?
I'm all right, mate. It's been a while. It's been a while since I saw that beautiful face of yours. Even though we started out together back in, what was that, mate?
2000 for me.
Okay, all right. So I arrived at Progressive in 98 and you arrived in 2000. Right. So we would have only worked together for a year or so. We've kept in touch, which is lovely.
Yeah.
The old S3 alumni. But I don't think I've been in your company since then, mate.
I don't think so. I don't think I've seen you for, it's easy, 20-odd years, isn't it? It's easy. Well, probably since you left, to be honest.
Yeah.
We might have done a video call over the years or something. I don't know. But no, I've not seen you. I've obviously seen your face a lot coming up on LinkedIn, to be honest. So I feel like I've seen you a lot because every time I open up LinkedIn these days, there you are. So I feel like I haven't missed you at all, to be honest.
Mate, probably sick of me, but mate, it is lovely. It's genuinely nice to have the opportunity to catch up with you again, mate. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for coming on Recruitment Journeys.
Thank you for inviting me.
I wanted to bring you on, mate, because I genuinely admire you from afar for a couple of reasons. You know, and I think it'd be an interesting story. First of all, we started out together, so it'd be nice to reminisce a little bit about the good old days or the bad old days, whatever category you want to put them into. You obviously do in a fashion what I do, but we'll come on to that in a minute. You know, you do a bit of a different spin on it. But you are a guy that I see who appears to have made recruitment work for you. And you seem to do it with ease, and you seem to do it with a smile on your face. And there aren't many people out there. No, that's not true. There are some people out there who make recruitment work for them, but most people are working for recruitment, right? But you seem to be having a wonderful, colorful life down there in Miami, and you've made recruitment work for you. And I want to talk about, you know, how that happened, how you went from working in a dreary office in Manchester doing IT recruitment to where you are surrounded by palm trees in Miami today. But mate, before we get into it, I've already given the good listeners, all seven of them, a bit of an introduction as to who James Wardy Ward is, mate. But in your own words, who are you, pal?
Thank you, Pete. I'm James Ward. Own and run Clarity R2R, have done for 17 years, 23 years experience in recruitment, originally from the UK, of course, and moved out to Miami 2 years ago, which is where I am now. So, yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
You're a Man United fan, mate.
Do you know what? Yes, but I don't really follow it that much. It's something that I get asked a lot here. And I can't say I've really been a football fan since the 90s, if I'm going to be, really honest. And of course, when you meet people out here, not even English, when you meet Americans straight away, you say, "Where are you from?" First of all, are you red or blue? And I'm like, okay, yeah, I am technically red, but I don't really follow it. You know what I mean? So I'm not a big football guy. Boxing's my thing.
Boxing's your thing, isn't it?
Boxing's my
Awareness. We
thing.
might
And yeah.
chat about this as we
Yeah.
get into the conversation. All right, mate. Well, look, thank you
Yeah.
so much for coming on.
Yeah.
This is Recruitment Journeys. I'll give the listeners a quick intro for anybody who hasn't heard this before. This is simply it's a chat. It's a chat with hand-selected recruitment identities, and all we do is we delve into your recruitment journey in the hope to educate, inspire, motivate anybody who might listen to your story and go, okay, I like a little bit of what Wardy has done. I might apply that to my life. And look, it might be a good opportunity for you to talk about how UK or Australian recruiters transition into the American market or but whatever it might be.
Yeah.
We'll just see what pops up, mate. We'll just see what pops up.
Yeah.
But we
All
do like to start the chat with a couple of little icebreakers to give the listeners a sense of who the person is behind the professional recruitment veneer that we see before us.
Yeah.
Mate, can you tell us something about James Ward that not many people know?
I can't swim. Can't swim.
That's actually not funny, mate, because if you find yourself in, has Miami got water? It's got loads of water, hasn't
I've got a swimming pool in my house. Well, in my house, outside my house. Claire's 12-year-old niece came over a few weeks ago, and she was teaching me in the pool. I don't know. I got basically I learned when I was a kid. I'd seem to forget to learn how to swim. And then I've never picked it back up. I'm not afraid of water or anything, but for whatever reason, I've not picked it back up, and I can't swim. So that's probably something that not a lot of people know.
So when you're in the water and you are attempting to swim, are you just sinking?
Not pretty, mate. It's not pretty. It's a lot of output for not a lot of return. Yeah, not a lot of return on the investment. We'll put it that way.
Brilliant.
So yeah, that's something that
Yeah.
some people might not know if they
Keep
was
that to yourself,
interested at
mate. Keep
all.
that to yourself. It's out there now. It's out there now. Not a problem in Manchester, but possibly a problem in Miami.
Well, like I said, I'm putting it right. I'm putting it right.
Good lad. Mate, not many people, this is probably an unfair but accurate statement. Not many people want to be a recruiter growing up. What did James Ward want to be when he was growing up in Blackpool, right? Is that right?
Yeah, originally from Blackpool, moved to Manchester in my early 20s, and joined S3, as I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But when I was when yeah when I was a kid, I didn't really have a I can't say that I had a specific career in mind. I did work experience as a car mechanic, but then realized that wasn't for me. And I think I was never very academic. I was never really into school. I think I've never really been into learning about something that I'm not interested in, if that makes sense. So, having to revise in subjects that I had no interest in just wasn't my sort of thing. So, didn't do great at school. I managed to get into sixth form, but yeah, didn't do very well there. I was a million miles away from being able to go to university. My results were really bad. And I think I was much more into the social aspect of school and college and having the banter and all that sort of stuff. So I think it became clear early on that I was going to get into some sort of sales or sales driven sort of role. And to be honest as well, I was very much into the idea of making my own way, being independent, being money driven, to be honest. I wanted, whilst my background was comfortable, it was very working class, I wanted to make something of myself and everything else. So being money motivated was very much at the forefront of my mind. So I think at the age of like 18, I kind of knew that was what I was going to start getting into, and like getting into double glazing sales and commission only sales and all that sort of stuff. So that's what led me towards recruitment in the end.
Where
But
did that come from?
can't say that.
Where did that work ethic designed to earn money, where did that come from? Was that just something that was in you? Was that coming from pressure from your parents?
No, not at all. Not at all. My mum and dad you know, never put any pressure on me at all, really. So they just wanted me to be happy. I didn't put any pressure on me academically or to go into any particular, you know, field. They was happy me doing whatever, as long as I worked hard and, you know, I was happy. So I can't say that there was one particular thing or one particular reason, apart from, I think, you know, growing up in South Shore Blackpool, you know, it's not the most, you know, salubrious of areas. I was definitely thinking I had bigger ideas for myself, I think, with regards to where my life was going to go. And I certainly didn't want to hang about in Blackpool forever. I think that was, you know, that was clear. So I think it was just more of a, I don't want to go down the hard luck story. I wanted a way out or anything like that. It wasn't that bad. Everything was, you know, everything was great. But I think I just had bigger ideas, you know, with regards to where I wanted to take my life. And I could see that a career like being in sales was an opportunity to do that, whereby you literally are responsible for your earnings. It's performance related. So I got into commission only sales when I was like 18, 19, and did that for 3.5 years. So, you know, and I was quite happy doing that. You know what I mean?
So how did that lead you to, I mean, look, that's if I, as a rec, if I get a candidate knock on my door who's done 3.5 years commission only sales, I'm all over them like a rash for obvious reasons. Because that's the university of life, right? But how did that lead you to the wonderful doors of the S3 group, mate? How did you break into recruitment?
Yeah, so I started doing commission only sales. Basically, I'll give you the long story short. I got into knocking on doors, double glazing, literally that kind of work, you know, knocking on doors in the evening, you know, instructing people having the tea and whatnot, and trying to get leads for double glazing for a rep to go around and power close them. That was the selling that I started doing.
Power close them. Did you say power close them?
Yeah, that was me doing power closing. That was like some of these other lunatics who worked at this double glazing firm. But anyway, I'd pass the lead on, and then they would go around and literally not leave these people's houses until they sold. You know, it was that kind of selling.
Yeah.
So anyway, I realized after a few months that wasn't for me. But at the weekends, they had like one of these like demonstration things in like a B&Q or whatever the equivalent is in Australia. And I approached a guy who owned an advertising firm, and he said, I'm not interested in the windows, but I own an advertising company. You know, you could make big money. I like your style. Come and have a chat with me. And I said, okay, yeah, fair enough. Went to go and see him. Sell an advertising space on a variety of different media, but it was commission only. And I had to stay away 4 nights a week. So I was driving all over the UK, all over Ireland, all over Scotland, out of Hebrides even. So I was doing that at 18, and I had to pay my own expenses. So not only was it commission only, I had to pay about £400 to go to work every week. And sometimes you'd have a bad week and you'd be down, you know, and, you know, you'd have to drive eight hours to get home, you know, on a Friday afternoon or whatever. So it was brutal, but equally, I didn't think it was brutal at the time because I quite liked getting out and about. You know, I was on my own. This was the days before smartphones and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, staying in dingy B&Bs all over the place. So, so it was good grounding, to be honest. And I was earning decent money. I was earning up to £1,000 a week at 19, you know, so I was doing all right.
Mate, what were you like at 18 and 19?
I think, like most 18 or 19 year olds, lads who live in Blackpool, I was a lad's lad, definitely. You know, I think we'll come on to it, but those early days of S3 were right up my street. I loved it, you know. That whole work hard, play hard sort of, you know, thing was up my street. And yeah, I was a lad, but I always worked hard. You know, I always worked hard. I always knew, you know, where my life was going and everything else. I didn't go too off the rails, but equally, I was definitely a lad's lad when I was, when I was younger.
So there you go. So there you are, 18, 19. You're more than qualified to take that experience into recruitment. But how did you find yourself? Did you see one of those infamous little telephone newspaper adverts telling you can make £100,000 in your first year?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, basically, I got to the end of the road a little bit with this firm that I was working for. I've been there 3.5 years, commission only. And whilst it was a great grounding, it wasn't a career. You know, I needed a career or wanted a career. I was getting a bit bored of being away all the time as well. So thinking, you know, something where, which is going to give me the same kind of earning, uncapped commission and all that kind of stuff. Something's going to give me that, as well as giving me the opportunity to develop a career, is ideally what I'm looking for. So I actually seen an advert in the paper, like you say, from a rec to rec, funnily enough.
Really?
Yeah. So I went to go and see them in Manchester. I can't remember the name of them. Went to go and see them in Manchester, and they said, yeah, you know, we've got these firms, and they put me in touch with Futures, Computer Futures, Progressive. I think I went to go see Hayes as well at the time. So yeah, it was driven by me wanting high earning potential, but also a career. You know, and I thought, brilliant, I got a base salary and I can sit in an office. That's amazing. Do you know what I mean? As well as commission, I thought that was like, compared to what I've been doing, that was like amazing.
Yeah,
that was what sort of started it.
Tiny salary. Then what did you get? 12 grand, 12,000 sterling salary?
15.
Whoa, 15. Mate, you kept that quiet.
Claire started on 12. My wife Claire started on 12 at Progressive. I started a consultant. Was you a resourcer?
Not at all, mate. You obviously negotiated hard and well. Well, mate, what was the interview process like to get into S3 for you?
I went to Manchester. I went to Manchester, the Manchester office. Seen the head of internal recruitment. I forget her name now. She's not. You know, she went not long after I started. I interviewed with her, Matt McManus, who ended up being my manager, was away on holiday at the time. So I interviewed with her, and then I went down to Birmingham for an assessment day. And I think Justin Hughes was there, Richard Buck. I think it might have been Ollie Craggs. Wow. I forget who else. But that was an all-day assessment. I got through that, and then I went down to the Wimbledon office. I had an interview with Justin Hughes, Arthur. What was his surname? I forget his surname. Who ran Europe? Arthur, maybe someone else. But yeah, I remember Justin at that point. I was saying, look, do people really earn 100 grand? Does it level with me? And he was pulling out people's paychecks and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, do you know what? Fair enough. And I still don't understand what this recruitment thing's all about, but whatever. If you can earn 100 grand, then, and I can sit in Manchester and I can move. I was up for moving to Manchester as well.
Yeah.
I was living in Blackpool, as mentioned before. Although I was away a lot, I was into moving to Manchester.
Yeah.
You know, the idea, I mean, you know, Manchester may as well be like, you know, LA or something. You know what I mean? It's like, it's
and especially quite, back then, mate, you know, it was buzzing,
yeah.
Right? It was absolutely buzzing.
Yeah, that was, you know, around the, well, when Manchester United were in the pomp, weren't they? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that was, you know, that was around that time, the Beckham era and all that.
I think the Hacienda was just about still open, maybe.
I missed it. I think it was 96 that closed, didn't it?
It did, okay.
96 or 97, yeah. So it was a bit before my time. But yeah, moved in 2000, March 2000, and... yeah, that's where it started.
And again, mate, so just for the benefit of the listeners, the S3 group sometimes gets a bad rap, you know, if anybody doesn't know. But back then, it was a little bit Wolf of Wall Street esque. We were required to work hard, play hard. And when I say required, what I mean by that, if you didn't go out on a Thursday night, it was frowned upon. I remember saying to one of my colleagues, yeah, I don't really fancy going out tonight, Thursday night. And they looked at me and went, nah, that's a bad career decision. Watto. And we all had these nicknames, didn't we?
I think I know who said that.
And then you come in on a Friday morning and the people who had been terrified of sleeping in would often just sleep under their desks, and you come in on a Friday morning and there'd be feet protruding from the desk. That was the S3 group. But I do remember you guys. So as I was perm, and we sat on one side of the office and you were contract, and we were actively encouraged to not necessarily dislike each other, but certainly not to trust each other. and certainly not to collaborate. That's just the way it was, and I suppose it worked in a fashion. But you flew, mate. You flew. I do remember again watching you from afar and seeing you and other people like Claire, your wife, just take to it like a duck to water, and very quickly start putting in big numbers, earning big numbers, getting promotions. You loved it, didn't you? It was made for you.
It was really, to be honest. It was up my street that time. It was up my street. That blend of you know, high earning potential, career development, being around really switched on people. Because again, I've been in an environment where, you know, it was commission only, but it attracted all sorts, to be honest. It wasn't necessarily the most professional thing in the world. But then I was, you know, I joined Progressive and everyone suited up, everyone looks smart, you know, there's some really talented salespeople. And, you know, some of the people that are on that Manchester sales floor, you know, it's hard to beat that talent. You know, there's some really seriously talented salespeople in that business at that time, and not just Manchester, of course, right across the group. But of course, I was exposed to what was in Manchester, and you know, it was quite inspiring at the time. And I was like, Jesus Christ, these people are serious. They're really good, and they were teaching me, a way of selling that I'd not experienced before. And you know, they were getting into spin selling techniques and objection handling techniques and all these different things that I was like, this is, I loved it, to be honest. I loved the psychology of selling, but then I equally loved the social aspect. I loved how close everybody was. Mm. I loved the fact that it was a lifestyle, and I loved that, you know, it was almost like you went to work with your friends, you went out most nights, you know, and I joke to Claire and other people sometimes that you actually needed the weekends to recover. So you didn't want to go out with your friends at the weekend. You almost wanted to recover because your weeks were that full on. So, I did enjoy it. And that's even why now, sorry to waffle on, but that's even why now, and don't get me wrong, I know the times have changed and everything else, but if you'd have told me 23 years ago that you've got to do half of the week sat at home to do tech recruitment, and I said, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'll go and do something else.
100%.
I absolutely do not want to be speaking to, respectfully, tech people sat in my bedroom. Why would I want to do that? That's ridiculous. Mm. You know, I want to be in an environment where I'm ringing the bell, banging the board, having the banter, listening to sales calls, you know, having camaraderie. That whole thing was really important, you know. So
the camaraderie, and I'm sure it wasn't exclusive to the S3 group, but the S3 group did camaraderie very well. And I've got some, I'm proud to say I've still got some really good mates from those days. I mean, Frank Wadsworth is my business partner. James McCoy was at my 50th month ago.
How's he doing?
He's doing good. Do you know, he's doing good. He's he's a dog trainer now.
He's a dog trainer.
He's a dog trainer. Wow. He's called the dog mechanic.
Fair play. Is he really? Right. Fair play to him. But yet again, you had the Scotland team, didn't you? I was big mates with Pete Watson. Paul Watson. Sorry. With Paul Watson. You know, we used to go out, you know, regularly with him, and like I say, Mitch Scenario, I'm still friends with. I still speak to Mitch, still speak to Matt. He's coming to Miami soon. I'm meeting up with Matt. Of course, I'm married to Claire.
Yeah.
You know, so she was, you know, and she and was then older contract. So,
yeah,
you know.
And then Francis Dunleavy was in Miami recently as well, you guys.
I met up with Fran last year. He's moved to Tampa. He was in Miami, met up with Fran. And Fran wasn't there that long.
It was such a melting pot of different people, right? There was proper working class people in there. There was educated people in there who possibly could have gone off to do something different, but they wanted to earn good money. There was people from the wrong side of the track who were just, they'd managed to charm their ways in. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
Really, really interesting bunch of people. And I look back on those days fondly. You know, the early S3 days. I think all of my time there, to be honest, I look back on it very fondly. Great people that I met, great career development. You know, very much, I was very much, I wouldn't go as far to say a rough diamond, but they certainly did a great job of polishing me up from where I was to the point of leaving. And even with regards to different management styles, you know, Matt was a great manager and director. And then I worked under Richard Buck for a few years over in Leeds. And, you know, he was a great manager also. And yeah, like I say, overall, just a great time.
So tell us about your career. So you started as a trainee, you sat in the Manchester office doing contract recruitment for a while. And then how long were you there in total at S3 Group?
6 years.
6 years. Okay. And then you went over as, did you go over to Leeds, to Yorkshire to launch Leeds? A one-off?
No. Basically, I was in Manchester. I did well in Manchester. I was there for 3 years. Of course, we had September the 11th. After being there for just over 18 months. So that was catastrophic market-wise. But, you know, did okay, changed markets and, you know, did all right. And so overall, I was considered, I would never say that I was top filler there, but I was always in the top, you know, 10 in the company or whatever. I was always, you know, I was reasonably high up there all the time.
Mate, can you remember what your best year was?
I think it was in my second year, because of course then we had September the 11th. So I think it was 400K.
Which is massive, contract. Right? Which is massive.
It was only my second year. It was my first full year, actually. I think it was just shy of about 390. That was my first full year. So I started in March 2000. And I think that those numbers were in 2001.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So my contract business was building in 2000. And then, of course, it built. And then we had September the following year. So I was always a reasonably top performer, and they had a Leeds office. It wasn't doing that well. I forget who was running it at the time. It wasn't doing that well. They were close to closing it, and this was in 2003, I believe. They were close to closing it, and their idea was, we'll send two top performers from other offices on a 6 month secondment to essentially save the office. And what the idea was, the two people that go over onto Conman will put you up in a flat and all that kind of stuff and develop a deal culture in there. You know, people that, you know, the idea was a couple of people who were strong performers but are also good environment setters, which I was, you know, always was. So yeah, basically they sent me over and Ben Broughton, who he's now got his own business, and I know a lot of people know who he is. So me and Ben went over there for 6 months. We shared a flat. We developed a bit of a deal culture. They got rid of most of the office apart from two people. We started smashing it. So I did like 10 deals in my first 10 weeks there. Got 10 out in 10 weeks. Slowly started hiring people. After 6 months, Ben went to Thames Valley to run the Reading office. And then I stayed on to run the Leeds office. And I did that for 3 years until I left. So, and we had a great time there, to be honest. We did well, you know, because the office was close to closing. We developed a really good culture there. Hired some great people. Stella Cronchy, Richard Lester, who is now high up at Sonovate. Kevin Harper, who works over at Fruition in Leeds now, and some really good people who ended up, you know, sticking around in the industry and doing some great things. And we hired all those guys as trainees.
Yeah.
So we had a good time. And then Declan O'Boyle came over not long after and ran Perth. Whilst I was running contract,
I'd forgotten that actually. Declan. Yeah. I mean.
I shared a flat with Declan as well.
I shared a house with Declan in Manchester for a while. That was an experience.
Right, that was an experience. Yeah.
Love him.
Same.
So all right, mate. Well, look, all right. So this next bit's interesting, right? Because you were clearly a talented IT recruiter. So I'm going to, you know, embarrassingly, compare you to me. I was a below average IT recruiter. I'm very, very happy to admit that. And I almost went into rec to rec as I was like, shit, I can't really do IT recruitment to any great level of success. So I better try this rec to rec gig. And thankfully that has been, I found my niche and that's worked well for many, many years. But you were totally different, mate. You were a great IT recruiter. And in fact, you know, your wife, Claire, she went off and started her own IT recruitment business, as many of your colleagues and peers did.
Yeah.
Why did you choose not to go and do IT recruitment and instead pivot? We all hate that word, but pivot into rec to rec. Why did you go down the rec to rec route, mate?
Yeah, good question. First of all, I wasn't still a biller when I left.
Okay.
I was a non-billing manager and had been for a couple of years. So I had no relationships. You know, I would have been under a non-compete or whatever anyway. But I had no relationships. So that was the first point. The second point, I had no relationships and it would have taken me a while to develop any, 6 months, 9 months at least, of really rebuilding from scratch. And like I said, I'd been on the phones, for a couple of years at that point. I've been, a non-billing manager. Mm. So that was the first thing. Second thing is the fact that, we had a lot of frustration trying to hire for my own team in Leeds, and people just weren't getting it. The agencies that we were using just weren't getting it. It was mainly driven, transparently speaking, did I have a desire to leave S3 and to set up a rec-to-rec business? No, I didn't. The thing that driven me really was the fact, I won't get into it in too much detail, but I was frustrated with what the opportunity looked like at S3 going forward. It didn't excite me, and most importantly, the earnings didn't excite me. I joined at a time where I'd missed the boat with regards to shares and equity and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So I'd missed that boat. Like, I joined in 2000. Of course, they floated in 2005, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I'd missed that boat, and if I'd have been there 5 years before and been doing the same job as what I'd been doing, I'm sure I'd have done really well out of that, but I didn't. And that's obviously nobody's fault. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So I got a very, very small amount of shares. Equally, I'd been living a bit of a, fast and loose lifestyle, with my earnings. I hadn't been saving much. I did buy a house, and I didn't have a huge, big, war chest behind me or anything. I've been spending pretty much everything. Even though I've been earning well, I've been spending it all. So I've never been great, on that side. And, I was always the kind of guy that if I earn it, I'd spend it. So anyway, things have come to a head with S3, and I was like, I need to just get out, and I need to get out. And like I say, I don't want to speak bad of S3, but it's just the right time for me to go.
Yeah.
Like I say, the earnings wise, it wasn't exciting me, with regards to the direction that I was going. So I had to do something on my own. I didn't want to go and work for anybody else. So I was like, okay, I need to do it on my own. It's going to take me too long. I haven't got the money behind me, to start doing, tech recruitment. But, there's an opening here with regards to nobody does this market, this R2R market,
right,
who has my kind of experience. I've been the client. I've been the candidate.
Mm.
I've been on both sides of the interview table here. I've been the hirer and I've been the hiree. I can give a unique insight into that market than other people that I can see that are in it. And I had an existing network that I could tap into straight away.
Mm.
So first of all, I could supply straight back into S3. I left on good terms. I could supply straight back in there. I had a network of peers, you mentioned there,
yep,
who had set up their own businesses, had gone off and were now directors in other businesses and whatnot. So I was able to supply straight into them from day one, So I had a network ready to go. So I did my first deal within 3 or 4 days, of setting up, which, don't get me wrong, it was lower level. I was doing trainees and whatnot to try and get the wheels turning for the first year or so. But then, you know, I was away. And like I say, it was mainly driven by I wanted to do something on my own. I needed to start earning and billing quick. Mm. And, you know, I didn't have, you know, if you really did, I love tech recruitment and dealing with tech folk. Not really. Find it, you know, I do enjoy speaking to salespeople who are like me.
Yeah.
I like speaking to people who I'm on the level with.
Yeah.
You know, business owners, senior level people in recruitment, the likes of me and you and, you know, mm. our clients and candidates. I quite like that. You know, I've got a commonality with that market.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, being with a software engineer, you know, okay, yeah, fine, yeah. I can do it, but I
always said the same. As soon as I got into RectorRec, I had something in common with my product, at the risk of sounding make them sound like a commodity. Whereas I never had anything in common with you know, IT dudes. I always joked that as a RectorRec, I had a unique skill in the sense that I could spot a failed recruiter, having been one myself. So which stood me in good stead.
Yeah, you've got a unique angle on that, mate. I suppose you must have. You did well.
I did all right. I kept the lights on, but nothing more. I think I had one special month, but apart from that, I think I made one club lunch, whereas you had your own designated table.
Did like a club lunch. That's the funny thing, by the way, with regards to club lunches. I think I put a post on it about it like a year or two ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the club lunches back then were obviously legendary, and now they are like industry standard everywhere. Now, did everybody do them back then, or was it an S3 thing that has then just kind of rippled out towards the whole industry globally? Mm. You know, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Like, you know, obviously, of course, going out for a meal with colleagues isn't, you know, an exclusive idea, but a Friday afternoon hitting a Target, you know, or getting suited and booted, and people don't do that anymore. But
the best part of it,
wasn't it?
The best part of it was, and I was usually the one watching you, rather than being involved myself, but I don't know what time it was. So it was 12 noon. You would basically stand up from your desk and everybody would watch you. Yeah. And, oh, there's Waddy, the bastard. He's offering another one. And I'm just watching you walk out.
Claire still jokes with me about it. For my first club lunch, I bought a purple Dolce & Gabbana suit. I thought I looked the nuts in it. Two button from flannels, beautiful. Claire said it was horrendous, and still reminds me about it to this day. So I thought it was cool, though.
I did the same. I bought one of those Ted Baker endurance suits.
Oh, right.
And I remember Declan saying to me, oh, that's good. You'll be able to sleep in it and then get up the following morning and it'll still look good.
Well, Declan probably thought about his clothes and made clothing decisions on whether or not, he could sleep in them and still pass it off the next day as work attire. That was probably that factored into his decision making, I imagine.
Brilliant.
So, mate,
you slotted into the RectorRec world seamlessly, and obviously enjoyed it much more. What in your opinion, having done it for a long time? Because there's not many people like you and I. There's a few who have done RectorRec for a long time, because it is a tough gig, despite what people think. What do you think makes a successful R2R? And I know that you're now focusing more on the senior end of the market, but you've been in the trenches for many years doing RectorRec. What's the secret sauce?
I think, look, you're selling to salespeople, aren't you? You know, and I think it's hard, isn't it, to teach a trainee, you know, to do that, to deal with experienced recruiters, you know, recruitment business owners or whatever. I think it's quite a hard, nuanced market to kind of get your head around. I think experience obviously is key. But, you know, if someone was starting out doing, you know, R2R in the UK or Australia, I mean, you can't be too obvious, I think. I think you've just got to be straight with people, you know, and I think, you know, I'd give that advice to anybody, obviously, of course, in any market. But people like, you know, the whole reason why I called the business Clarity is for transparency.
Mm.
You know, that was the whole idea, you know, and why I called it that is like, look, I've been on that side of the table. You know, you can trust me. I'll talk straight with you.
I'm going to be honest with you.
I'm just going to be, you know, super straight with you. So I think what, if anyone was going to be doing this market, then you just got to be straight with people because switched on recruitment business owners, leaders, top billers, whatever, will see right through you, you know, and call it what it is. You know, if a business, you know, if I don't know, of course, we all have to maybe, you know, dress up feedback a little bit here and there, or, you know, polish something up. But equally, you've got to be straight with people. And nobody minds bad news, but nobody likes bad news to be hidden and kind of, you know what I mean? You know, so I think just honesty and transparency, I think is key.
With clients as well, clients and candidates. I have a bit of a rule where when I'm presenting a candidate, because nobody is perfect. I don't think I've ever presented a candidate who's absolutely perfect. And I will highlight that candidate's weaknesses and shortfalls probably on first presentation, because they're going to find out anyway.
Yeah.
So let's just get it out in the open.
Yeah. I get, you know, there's no point saying, oh, this guy's excellent. He's the best guy you're ever going to see. You know, it's like, you're going to interview him. They're going to interview him more thoroughly than what you've interviewed them.
Correct.
And then you're going to have egg on your face.
Correct.
So you can either say, look, it's up to you if you want to interview this guy or girl. This is why I presented him or her to you. But this is what I think you're probably going to, you know, maybe pick up on. Up to you if you want to interview. And then if you want, you know, that's fine. So not wanting to get into technical.
Because rhetoric's very technical, mate.
Just being honest. Just being straight with people, I think.
Mate, do you think having done both to a high level, do you think rhetoric is harder than IT recruitment?
No, I think tech recruitment is significantly harder.
Really?
To be honest. Yeah. Significantly harder.
Wow.
I mean, when I speak to, you know, leaders and you know, top performers and whatever, it's such a. I mean, these people can't even, you know, when you're doing that market, you can't even get somebody on the phone. We've got no problem getting someone on the phone, a client or a candidate, no problem whatsoever. We've got no problem getting someone's numbers. We don't have gatekeeper issues. We don't have preferred supplier issues.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have any of that. All we've got to know is what we're talking about. And if you know what you're talking about, then you'll be able to have the ability to influence and sell your services. Whereas you're in tech recruitment, you've got to start building communities, and you've got to start building, you know, all sorts of, you know, adding value to your community and all this kind of stuff. And hopefully you'll be seen. And then it's such a difficult market. And I respect, and when you hear about, you know, people who are billing, you know, big numbers, that's not easy. You know, that's not easy. So this is miles easier, mate. This is miles easier.
Yeah.
But can I say, sorry to interrupt, this market, or dealing with the recruitment market, is hard when you start dealing with low performers. When you start dealing with average people, I'm just going to be really honest here. When you're dealing with average people or poor performers or juniors, trainees, that's when it's hard. That's when it's hard. If you focus on the top 10% of the market, either billing or leadership level talent, and the same from a client perspective, you've got no problem. It's I wouldn't say it's easy. No recruitment market's easy, but it makes your job easier.
There's a level of respect, professionalism, understanding, which just greases the wheels.
They don't
right?
ghost you. They don't ghost you as much. You know, they don't. You know, the interview. You don't need to over prep them. They're gonna. You know what I mean? I think that's the same in all markets. The higher the level, the stronger the candidate, the stronger the client, the easier you are to represent on either side, and it makes your job easier. But when you start dealing with the, you know, the lower levels, then that's when it's not making it harder for yourself.
The amount of times people have said to me, I could not do your job for all the Team China. And I inquire as to why. And they all say the same thing, which is, well, you're dealing with recruiters, aren't you? They're all liars. They're all bullshitters. They're all charlatans. And I say, well.
And there,
well,
are, there is.
Yeah, and there's an element of that. But when you've done the job for a while, you can see those people 1,000 miles away, and you simply don't represent them. It's as simple as that. Yeah. You just walk away from the relationship. I will say, though, in response to what you've just said, when we came into that post-COVID boom and every recruitment business on the planet wanted 50 people tomorrow, and the talent just wasn't there, I did something that I hadn't done for almost 20 years, which was I started placing rookies. I stuck a good old-fashioned, which is the opposite of what you've done, but we'll come to that in a minute. I stuck a good old-fashioned advert out on Seek, which is our online job board. And I was horrified to open my laptop the following morning. There's like 78 applications. I was like, okay, that was a mistake. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. But I started placing rookies because of market demands, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thoroughly enjoyed it because if you find the two or three diamonds per month, these are young, smart, credible, hungry, intelligent people, and they listen to your advice, they take your guidance, they hang off your every word, they do what you ask them to do. So they're actually easy placements. And then when they get the job, they're super grateful. And then you see those people, they stay in the job, they thrive. And like 2 years later, you know, a lot of them are still in the job. A lot of them are still not in the job, by the way.
And
I found it really, really rewarding. I've stopped doing it now because the market doesn't want rookies anymore, and that's fine. But I did it. I did it for a year or so, and it was I just loved it. Loved it.
You
couldn't do it, could you?
To be honest, no, I didn't. I didn't really. And as soon as I could, I stopped it. I think I did it at first, and then I hired a guy early on that was doing it for me as well. And yeah, it wasn't, I think it's expected that you're going to get a dropout rate. You know, I think, you know, you have to manage a certain percentage where you either expect them to drop out, i.e. not even start, or certainly leave within rebate. And then when you're having to put a lot of time into to the qualification of them and the prepping anyway, and the fee is shit, to be honest, then, you know, is that a good market to be in?
I get it. And I think I did it in response to the market at the time, because it was simply, I don't know about the US or the UK, but in Australia, there's just no talent, and it had to be found somewhere. So you've gone the opposite way, mate. You've gone to the top of the tree. Tell us about kind of what you're, where you're specializing at the moment.
Yeah, so I suppose three areas, really. I mean, it's all sort of senior leadership level within predominantly technology recruitment across the US. So I do leadership search. So that's anything from sort of billing manager, or in the US, associate vice president, AVP level, up to, you know, president level, board level. But doing a lot of that sort of VP level, which is the kind of level whereby they'd be leading an office, possibly two, you know, that kind of level. So yeah, leadership search at senior management level, essentially. Also, done a lot of work around full team lifts. So firms that maybe wanna launch in the US or set up second offices, third offices, new brands, that kind of thing. Then we've lifted entire teams, you know, for some of those people. And also investment and startups. So again, people at leadership level that might be interested in setting up their own firm and looking for investment or startup accelerator partners or operational startup partners, then, you know, we connect them with those too. So again, people that might be at associate vice president, vice president or higher level, that are interested now, maybe they've reached the end of the line, a bit where, like where I was. You know what? Maybe this corporate life isn't for me anymore. I want to do my own thing. I want to build, you know, some real, unlock some financial freedom for myself. And, you know, I connect them with investment and investment partners and operational partners. So yeah, those three areas in the US. Of course.
Okay. So it's all in the domestic US market.
Yeah.
Rather than relocating people into the US.
Yeah. I don't do a lot of relocations. I mean, if someone comes along, I think generally you do that when you're still in the UK, because UK network's active from a candidate perspective, and you know, you're speaking to more people in that market that want to relocate. I still get contacted, you know, about the odd one here and there, but generally speaking, I'm placing Americans, or certainly people that have got a right to work in the US. Occasionally Brits that are here that need a transfer visa wise, but in the main, very much on the ground.
So back in the day, you made the glamour move from Blackpool to Manchester. And then 2 years ago, you made the glamour move from Manchester to Miami. Why Miami? Why the States?
Yeah, good question. It was always a dream, really, to move out to the US. You know, from a lifestyle point of view, I always wanted to do it. As a younger man, I was very much into the idea of going to New York. You know, I think, you know, a lot of people have that, you know, have those ideas. But as you get older, you start looking at New York a bit more closely and you think, oh, is that really, I don't know about that anymore. Yeah. But also as well, you know, I had my own business. My wife had her own business. And we was like, it's not like, you know, like people can these days, or just go and get sponsored and you're out there in 3 months. You know, I couldn't do that. I had my own business. And we had some family obligations, and my wife had her business, and you know, and everything else. So it took us a while to actually make the move. And whilst we was sort of weighing it up for years, we was thinking about different locations. And like I say, New York was you know, first up, and kind of decided against that. And then, yeah, we looked at California, and we very nearly made the move to California. COVID slowed it down really, but we very nearly moved to LA and was going to come for an extended trip, and COVID of course came along, wiped it all out, and we started looking at it a lot more closely. I think, you know, it's easy to make an emotional decision with the US in terms of where to be based. Oh, I like going on holiday there, so I love living there, and it's not necessarily the case. We looked at, you know, a lot of the commercial reasons are, you know, within California, and you know, taxes, cost of living, even getting around in LA, you know, the bad homeless problem there, and a few other factors, and the time difference to the UK made us think, you know what, maybe what are we really going there for? We're going for climate, we're going, you know, to live a lifestyle. Maybe we can get that. And then it was around the time that there was a lot of talk about Miami as being a lot of migrations were coming from other states. You know, the mayor was doing a lot with regards to attracting businesses here, and it was, you know, the next tech hub and all this kind of stuff. And it had a lot of what we was looking for. We've been here a few times. We came here on our honeymoon, funnily enough, with no desire or plan to move here. So we just started thinking about it during COVID, and like, do you know what, maybe Miami we should consider. And then we thought more and more about it, looked into it more and more, and yeah, decided on here. So in answer to your question, US was always on the roadmap from a lifestyle point of view, but it just so happened that commercially it made sense as well, because I was doing more and more work out in the US from the UK. Same reason everybody else. The fee levels are significantly higher. The salaries levels are significantly higher. You earn more money here than you do in the UK, and you've got a better lifestyle. And that really is the bottom line as to why we made the move.
In a nutshell, what's the key differences between recruiting in the US and recruiting in the UK? Is it? I say that. So what? Good to give that question some context. I find that when I'm speaking to UK recruiters who are coming to Australia, I always say to them, you will find when you get here that recruitment as an industry, as a profession, is much more respected than it is in the UK. You know, when you're doing some business development, people are going to say, yeah, I'll meet you for a coffee over here. They're not going to tell you to F off down the phone. And, you know, it's just a more civilized industry. What are the key differences between the States and the UK?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of differences. I mean, I am still dealing a lot with UK firms that are out here. So, you know, a lot of my client base, business owners and whatnot, are English, you know, from the UK. But like I say, I am mainly placing Americans. And I do deal with the US market as well. But to this point, it has majority been UK firms that are out here. You do find, certainly when you come off the beaten track, if you don't do New York and you're, you know, doing some other areas and like, you know, Dallas or, you know, some people, you know, in some of these areas that are in US firms, you know, I mean, sometimes you've got to explain what it is that I do. They don't get it. You know, they think that I'm approaching them to come and work for me.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and they don't understand that I'm the connector and I'm the agent, you know? Yeah. So in terms of attitudes, I don't really want to, you know, sort of, you know, be disrespectful to the UK here, but people are just much nicer. You know, people are just much nicer, much more respectful. you know, they're much more, you know, if they say they're not interested, I'm generalizing here, obviously, but you know, they give you, you know, if you message someone, they'll write you my next message back, you know, and, you know, it, you know, a big thing as well is networking calls, you know, so I'm not looking, but I'm open to a networking call or an intro call. So, you know, people are happy to speak to you. And again, I'm generalizing, not everyone is, but people are happy to speak to you, even if they're not looking. You know, and that's just not a thing in the UK. People, you know, people just aren't interested in speaking to you unless they really need you. And I understand why. You know, they get hit up much more by people. They can't speak to everybody. But because the people that I may be approaching don't get hit up much, they're happy to have an intro call or a networking call or whatever. So you do find that, generally speaking, people are just much more open with the time. They appreciate what it is that you're doing. And they understand the value in networking and getting to know someone for as and when. Now, a common one that I hear a lot is, well, I tell my candidates to take calls, so I should, shouldn't I? I'm like, well, yeah.
Networking calls, I've never heard that. I mean, it's obvious what it is. It's self-explanatory, but they don't exist over here in Australia.
Do they not?
No, not really. No, nobody's ever said to me, give me a call and we'll network.
I wouldn't have done it myself, to be perfectly honest. But it's very much a thing here, and like I said, people are open to, you know, to chatting and speaking, and also as well, another thing, you know, people, you know, very, again, understand the value in networking, so they offer referrals like quite openly, without asking. You know, that's another thing. They understand the value that, okay, well, you know, if I can help you, then, you know, that's good. That's good karma. That goes around, comes around, and, you know, we'll keep in touch and all this kind of stuff. So, again, generalizing, not everyone's like that, but, you know, that attitude is much more a thing here, which is a big difference between here and the UK.
So do you find that you've, in the same way that you were a duck to water when you arrived at S3, have you immersed yourself effortlessly into the American way of recruiting? Does it suit you at this stage of your life?
Yeah, it does. I would say that, you know, I'm in, you know, deep into my 40s now. And, you know, I was a bit disillusioned for a few years. Not disillusioned, but I was like, was I loving it? Not really. It was a means to an end, you know. The US thing was quite a way away. Mm. And I was just doing it for the sake of doing it, you know, because, you know, I didn't have a desire to grow in the UK. Like I say, I was doing it for the sake of doing it. But, you know, the US is almost like a new chapter of
life.
My career and my business. Yeah, it's a new chapter. It's a new stage of my career. So, and I find it much more exciting, much certainly with regards to the opportunity and the scale of the opportunity out here and the country itself, and, you know, and everything. It's much more exciting with regards to what is happening here than respectfully what is happening in the UK. So I would say that it's given me a, you know, I have taken to it, you know, answer your question. So
on that, mate, what's what does the future look like for James Ward?
I mean, it's obviously been a funny year, hasn't it, for many. I did hire a couple of people, you know, didn't work out, hired the wrong people, you know, my mistake. I've paused on that this year with the market being as it is. I mean, overall, it's going to be a good year. But I think also as well, when I first got here, I probably wasn't respectful just quite how expensive it is. It's expensive to live here. It's expensive to hire here. And it's even more expensive to make the wrong hiring decisions here, particularly when it comes directly out of your pocket. So that's something that we've just paused on this year. But like I say, we are going to be hiring again, and that's very much part of the plan. So yeah, I'm going to start bringing some people on sort of at the beginning of next year. I'm likely going to bring people on that are top performers in my market. Who place leaders and senior level people into the recruitment market out here. So I'm keen to do that, probably from the UK or, you know, or elsewhere. There isn't a lot of people doing this market here. which is good and bad.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, mate, given the fact that the Director Rec concept is almost in its infancy to some degree, that's you could be a pioneer, mate.
There's a handful of people here, and they're spread out all over. There's one or two in New York, and there's a couple, one or two in Austin, and dotted around. But that's about it. Apart from that, people are doing it from the UK. I don't know if people do Australia, probably not, based on the time difference, but. So obviously hiring people with experience in my market isn't easy. It's a relocation thing, but that's what we're going to try and do.
Good luck, mate. If anybody can do it, it'll be your good self. Now, mate, thank you so much. I love that. Yeah. I loved every minute of it. Now, how we wrap this up, James, is we wrap it up with a quick kind of succinct advice section at the end. We have four hypothetical recruiters at different stages of their careers. And I think you're qualified to offer advice to each of these people, if you don't mind. So the idea is, people at different stages of their career might be listening in and you might be able to offer them advice about the stage of career that they're at and what they do next.
Okay.
It'll make more sense when I actually ask you the questions, mate, I promise. The first one is, what advice would you give somebody starting their first recruitment role next week?
Forget what you think you know. And just, this is going to sound harsh, do what you're told by people who have done it. And remove any emotion from, I don't want to do this, or I called him, or I didn't want to do it. Just listen to what you're being told from people who have done it at a high level and performed at a high level.
Yeah.
My thing when I first started at Progressive was, I'll do anything. Just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Do you know what I mean? So stick me next to the top performer. I'll listen to what they do and I'll just do that. Simple.
Yeah.
I'll just speak the words down the phone that I'm being told.
Yeah.
And it'll work out. It's almost like, almost like be a baby about it with the Garcia mentality. Just remove all your emotion and just do what you're told.
Do what you're told.
That sounds really harsh, doesn't it?
Yeah. I love it. Mate, thinking about the amount of people that we as RetorX see drop out of the industry after 18 months, a couple of years, which is a travesty. You see so much good talent falling by the wayside because they just haven't had a great first experience in recruitment. What advice would you give to somebody 2 years in who hasn't yet found their groove and they're thinking about leaving the industry? What would you say to those people?
It's a broad question, isn't it? Because there's a lot of different reasons as to why they're not finding the groove. But, unfortunately, a lot of people do join the wrong business. They don't know that. Because they just believe what they're told at interview. I felt lucky, you felt lucky by joining a business that was as great as S3. I could have quite easily joined the wrong business. Mm-hmm. I think I had a good idea for what I was looking for.
Yep.
But I still felt lucky. I felt that, we joined arguably the best recruitment group for training, and foundational, the foundation of success that we could have done. So I think, is it the wrong business? And you've got to look around and think, okay, what's the retention like here? Is there a bad churn? Is the people doing well? If there's a lot of people around you doing well and you're not, then I suspect you have to look at yourself. And what is it that you're not doing? And I think a big thing in this industry, which a lot of people lack, is self-reflection, self-awareness, humility, and coachability, essentially. Well, I know they kind of all mean the same thing. But, there's so many people in this industry that are like, won't take advice, won't take it, and it's always someone else's fault. The finger is always pointing in a different direction rather than themselves. And anyone who's any good at this game will always be able to say, there's always something more I could have done there in that deal or that situation. I could have maybe done this. I could have maybe done that. And those little tiny percentage points sometimes make the difference between winning and losing. And I think there's a lot of people in the industry that just don't like to admit that it's their fault. So they need to look around and think, am I surrounded by the right people? Are these people all performing well? Now, don't get me wrong. Just because they're performing doesn't mean, you know, you can put, and it may be a culture that you don't necessarily agree with or respond well to, or, you know, or whatever. But I would say, first of all, look at your surroundings. Is it a high performance business? Is it full of people that are performing well? Is the culture generally accepted as being strong and positive and inclusive and, you know, all those sorts of things? And if they are, then highly likely you're the problem, you know? So there's another thing as well in the fact that, you know, there's people who sometimes have been in it a year or 2 years, and, you know, they don't want to do the boring, consistent, hard yards every day. They want to try and find a shortcut somehow. You know, and they don't want to pick up, I'm going to sound like an old man here, but they don't want to pick up the phone. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to, you know, do all the boring stuff that ultimately, you know, lead you towards, you know, towards a foundation for success. So sometimes these people, they're probably not suited. If you really don't want to do it and you're being told this is how you do it and you still don't want to do it, go and do something else. Go and do something else.
Goes back to the first point, mate. Do what you're told.
Yeah. Do what you're told. And if you won't do what you're told, but it's clear that it works, go and do something else.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not for you. Go and, you know, go and work at the civil service or something, or I don't know, whatever. But this isn't for you. You can't want all the accolades and the money, but not do what's required in order to get it. You can't argue with the process. The process is the process. Either accept it or don't.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sorry,
good advice, mate.
Yeah, right.
Mate, what advice would you give to somebody? Yeah, you did sound like an old man. You are an old man, mate.
Right. Yeah, I am an old man.
What advice would you give to somebody looking to take their first step into management?
I mean, this is an interesting one because a lot of people think they have to go down the management route. That aren't necessarily natural leaders, you know, or managers. So I would say, why do you want to do that? First of all, you know, is it genuinely how you see your career developing? You need, of course, to the traits that would lead you to be a top performer aren't necessarily the same traits to be honest, that would lead you to be a top manager. So, you know, you've heard it a million times, as I'm sure, you know, as I have. You know, some people are just too selfish. You know, to be managers, you know, they're not wired in that way. So I would say, you know, why do you want to be a manager? You know, is that the route that you genuinely want to take, you know, in your career? Are you accepting the fact that you're going to earn less? Because you will. You'll earn less. You know, you're going to have to share maybe your clients or, you know, or whatever it is. So, you know, you will earn less for doing more. And you've got to be okay with that. So, I would really question, you know, is that the route they want to take and why? And really examine that rather than just sticking a top performer down the management road that they're not necessarily cut out for. Yeah. And then it's quite hard to bring them back into a top biller capacity or top performer capacity or whatever it may be.
Yeah, yeah. Final question, my friend, before I let you get back to the Miami sunset. What advice would you give somebody looking to strike out on their own, start their own recruitment business?
Yeah, that's a good one, because I have this conversation a lot with people. What advice? It's a grind, obviously. So, you know, are you prepared to build something from nothing? Now, the interesting thing about this is the fact that I put some on LinkedIn about it a couple of days ago. The interesting thing about this is the fact that a lot of people are back in build mode if they wasn't already. So, you know, rebuilding teams may have been cut. Their teams may have been cut. You know, there's no income in business. They're having to maybe get back on the phone if he wasn't already, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're rebuilding again. So some people think, you know what? This has been in the back of my mind for a while. If I'm going to rebuild anyway, maybe I should do it for myself. I think these days it's very different to set up on your own than what it was, you know, many years ago. There's networking groups around, you know, where you can share ideas and, you know, this sort of thing, even co-working spaces, to be honest, you know, compared to years ago, like, you know, WeWorks or whatever, which weren't around, you know, he was in a, you know, small little box room or whatever. There wasn't this sort of open collaborative kind of thing in co-working spaces that you get now. So, you know, dare I say, you're not as much on your own as what you know, you would have been years ago. Yeah. Equally, you can join, you know, startup accelerator firms where there's, you know, there's a community of other co-founders that are, or other founders that are going through the same thing as you. Mm. So I think that, you know, advice, you know, of course, you know, it is going to be different. But if you feel that you've reached the end of the road with regards to what you can learn, and if it's a case whereby, you know, you bring all the clients in, you place them, you manage the team, and all you're getting is kind of maybe a pat on the back and a base salary, then you should do it on your own. Mm. You know, you should do it on your own, because that is, unless you join a business at the right time that's going to be going through an event, that really is the only way to unlock, you know, financial freedom, really, in this industry, unless you join a business at the right time that ends up going through an event. But that's very hard to know which bus to jump on, you know, in that regard.
And people always think that one of the things that, you know, people procrastinate, right? One of the things that puts people off doing their own thing is, well, what if it fails? And if it fails, that's okay.
Go and get a job.
I don't know a single employer out there that would look at a CV of somebody who's had a crack for 18 months and for whatever reason it didn't work, and then that will be a black mark against their name. It's never the case. People are just, they're accepting that you had a crack. It just didn't work. You've scratched that itch. 100%. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Audie, thank you, mate. You're a very wise man. I can see why you're very good at your job. I've learned a few things, my friend. Learned a few things.
Really? Fair enough. Hopefully it's been it's been insightful. But I've enjoyed it, mate. Good to catch up.
Mate, I'm genuinely, it's been lovely to reconnect with you after all these years. It really has. But I'm very, very happy that you and Claire have found your place in Miami. I hope it works out for you for the long term.
Thank you.
I know you're not a football fan, but have you been down to see Messi yet?
I haven't.
The tickets are gold dust, are they?
Yeah, I think I can't remember what the tickets were. They were like next to nothing, $25 or $50, and now like $400 or something.
Yeah.
Or they have been. So, yeah. But no, everyone's walking around here wearing Messi shirts. His kids go to school around the corner from our house, actually.
Nice. It must be great. It must be good because you're experiencing a sporting moment in history, right? Around on your doorstep.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, the city is, I mean, look, we've only been here 2 years, but, you know, it's very exciting with regards to what's going on here. And like I say, Messi coming is obviously such a big deal. And, Beckham's place, you know, down in downtown. And, you know, you hear about, you know, everyone who's coming here or relocating here and what's going on with the city. And it's very much, there's a huge amount of like investment and development being put into the city. So, I mean, it's exciting anyway. It's a cool place anyway, but, you know, it's only going to get better as well, which is you know.
I wonder if part of Messi's decision making to move to Miami was he heard you'd moved there.
Probably, mate.
That was part of it.
Yeah, Beck said, "Look, do you mind sending him a quick voice note and just sort of like maybe nudging this over the line?" I said, "Yeah, of course, mate. No problem.
Leave it with me."
I was happy to help.
Mate, it's been lovely to talk to you. I'm delighted that we've reconnected because I've now got somewhere to stay when I come to Miami on holiday in a few years. And
welcome anytime.
Good man. Thank you so much, Wardy.
Come on. All right, mate. See you soon. Cheers. Bye.
And that concludes another episode of Recruitment Journeys. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, it would be awesome and really appreciated if you could like, share, or subscribe, or ideally all three. Again, we don't ask for much at Recruitment Journeys, just a little bit of love. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time for the next episode of Recruitment Journeys.